Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. The theme today? How do people around the world view the United States in its quest for empire? We have three panelists, one coming from Japan, the other from Canada, and one from Germany. They'll all be on Skype, so please excuse some of the technical challenges of having Skype equalized versus what would be if you were in a studio. But we're going to talk first from Germany with Roman Baldzus, an economist, financial analyst, who has specialized in the software marketing industries. He has studied in the areas of his expertise from universities in technology in Germany, where he resides. He's a leading contributor to the German financial newspapers, and his articles have appeared on Global Research and also Paul Craig Roberts' blog. And he will be followed by Professor Gary Leach from Canada, and finally Professor Andrei Vilcek, who's in Japan. Nice to have you with us today, Roman.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for having me on your program.
Recently, we've been observing a popular backlash in Europe against the pressures and influence of the American foreign policies, and particularly our economic policies that have been tied to major corporations. For example, Europe continues to ban many American-made products, such as dairy and beef, because of the various chemicals and hormones and other toxic substances used to raise dairy and meat cattle. And while genetically modified foods are rampant in the United States, and the Obama White House and his predecessors refused to label GMOs, in Europe there's a larger popular demand to ban GMOs. Already, most European countries require food labeling of products with GMO ingredients, and more recently, with events in Ukraine and the Edward Snowden revelations on just how extensive the U.S. intelligence agencies are spying on Europeans and their leaders, even German Prime Minister Merkel's mobile phone, people on the other side of the Atlantic are waking up that the United States is not the best friend, nor has European populations in their best interest. I feel the recent pressures being made on European countries to cut ties with Russia and adopt Obama's sanctioning policies also has Europeans worried and alarmed. And again, many Europeans are outraged at Israel's slaughter of innocent Palestinians, the confiscation of land, the full wholesale destruction of massive amounts of infrastructure from the power utility company. So now Palestinians, over 1,500,000, have no water, have no electricity. Most have no homes, and they're living in abject destitution. Europeans see that story. Americans don't. Europeans have correspondents there talking with people showing the suffering of the innocent Palestinians. Now, I'm not talking about Hamas and anyone who is a terrorist and anyone who launches a rocket. I'm talking about women and children, 500 children dead. I'm talking about thousands and thousands made homeless. Europeans see them, hear them. Not one appears anywhere in the American media. You wouldn't know that story. All you hear here is they have a right to self-defense. The tunnels were used to attack Israel. End of story. And especially from the Christian Zionist in the United States and from the conservative Zionist in the United States and in Israel. They control our media, they control our legislature. And that then changes how Americans are perceived when we don't seem to have any compassion for victims of our or anyone else's military interventions or economic sanctions. And so I'd like for you to start off from an essay which you wrote that appeared in Global Research in Paul Craig Roberts' site. Political Europe suppressed under Washington's thumb is waking up. And due to the deep economic ties between the U.S. and Europe, how much economic suppression is the United States exerting on European states? And start by taking a look at Ukraine. Tell us what we know to be the most realistic scenario of what has occurred there versus what we have been told by the United States media in the United States. The forum is yours. Take your time.
That's a very good question. So what do you observe in Europe since the Western announcement of imposing sanctions against Russia is a deep social divide between proponents and repudiators of such measures. It is a society that is deeply split in two diverging camps, and this especially counts for Germany. And this is exactly what could have been anticipated before taking such extreme measures. Look, what would it take to de-escalate the conflict between Russia, the West, and Washington's puppet regime in Kiev? To be honest, not too much, if the different parties would agree to sit at the table to find a diplomatic solution to the ongoing crisis. So where do you see anything like this? Instead of finding a diplomatic solution for what Russia has called since the beginning of the Ukrainian crisis, Washington and the West are escalating the conflict. I think the reason is that nothing has worked out in favor of the West since Washington sponsored an orchestrated coup in Kiev, which led to the overthrow of a, yes, highly corrupt government of Viktor Yanukovych, but a government that was democratically legitimated by a majority of Ukrainian voters. So the East Ukrainian Donbass is of major importance to Russia since 80% of Russia's jet and bomber engine production comes from this region. And there is much more. Same counts for the strategic importance of Russia's Sevastopol naval base in Crimea, where even nuclear submarines are located. Did you want to see thugs and bullies of Kiev's right sector movement going down there to take over? Would it not have been a much greater threat to the world if such dangerous and hardly accessible people took control over weapons like this? This is the question not only I'm asking myself. Lots of people, I think, share my opinion. And what do you have... Or would you have expected Putin and the Kremlin to be thrown out of their Black Sea naval base by the Kiev regime, which is backed by the U.S. and NATO? This is Russia's only bridgehead to enter the Mediterranean Sea. And don't forget Syria, where Russia operates another naval base of strategic importance in Tartus. So... And look what's happening in the eastern south of Ukraine since the Nazi right sector forces are fighting alongside with regular Ukrainian troops against the separatists. Have you heard of the crimes they are committing on a daily basis against Russian-speaking civilians in these regions of the country? Do you hear Western mainstream media talking about this? If not, your listeners should ask themselves why. You know what's really interesting? In this context, I want to refer to a conversation with Jared Salandi, the founder of the Trans Journal. 1.5 years back, I think it was in March 2013, I made an interview with him just the same way we are doing it right now. And we spoke about geopolitical tensions, the situation in Iran, the Middle East, and so on. And all of a sudden, Jared said, "Roman, and now you see the new alliances are forming." It was a time when Xi, China's new president, came into office. So Jared went on to say, and where does Xi go? Does he go to visit Obama in the White House? No, he goes to Moscow to visit Putin. And by the way, if it came to a war between the West and Russia, I would place my bets on Russia, China, and Iran. "Look," he said, "Napoleon couldn't beat the Russians. Hitler couldn't beat the Russians, and you want to tell me that these ignorant and arrogant fools in the White House, their NATO vessels, and their little Arab League can beat the Russians? So the Americans can't even win a war," he told me. "Yeah? They lost in Iraq, they lost in Afghanistan, they messed up in Somalia and lost in Vietnam, and in Iraq and Afghanistan they even lost with the British and some other NATO vessels helping them." So we spoke about this topic long before the crisis in Ukraine broke out, and now you have it. So here we go. Yeah, the Western mainstream media is full of warmongering, just transporting the message they are forwarded by NATO head Mr. Rasmussen. And it's not only this. When it comes to the Ukrainian crisis center, evidence is huge that the Western mainstream is just adopting information created by these guys out of thin air. Now, so in Germany, we say it's Monday again. Monday is usually the day on which the next propaganda lie that comes out of Kiev's Ministry of Defense is spread around the world by media operators who don't even take the time to severely analyze or research such information. They just adopt them and seem to be in a race who's first in spreading the next propaganda lie, being supportive and demonizing Putin and Russia. So what does that have to do with investigative journalism? Yeah, this is the question. This is not more than propaganda at its best. Don't you think that the Chinese sit and watch how this whole thing is going to play out? They know they will be next. Yeah. So have you been provided with any credible evidence out of Washington, the State Department, NATO, or Western mainstream media that Russia or the East Ukrainian rebels are behind the downing of Malaysian passenger airliner MH17? What they are doing is just to point fingers towards Russia without coming up with hard evidence. Yeah. Ah, here we have some intelligence photos. Yeah, we want to provide the world with. Yeah, you can't even be sure that this poor material hasn't been Photoshop adjusted beforehand. So what they are saying is to have credible evidence, but sorry, we are not supposed to release or publish it. I mean, what's that? And after all, what Washington orchestrated 12 years back, think about Saddam, Iraq, and weapons of mass destruction, you mentioned them, that have not been found up to today and will not be found. Yeah, you want to believe this U.S. government a single word? I'm just reminded to former U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell, who spread his lies about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction not only among the members of the United Nations, but in the whole world. At the time, Washington was told by so many experts not to actively intervene in the Middle East, but they did anyway. Yeah, these guys set the whole Middle East in flames because of what? Because of selfish and individual oil interests standing behind and whispering into the ear of the Washington government. So what did Obama tell the American people recently? Sorry, folks, we don't have a strategy yet. Yeah, so would it perhaps be better, as Ron Paul said yesterday, to not even come up with a strategy? So perhaps it would be better to completely stay out of this self-created mess and focus on a solution for the immense problems at home. Would perhaps have been better to spend $5 trillion wasted taxpayer dollars on a renewal of the rotten U.S. infrastructure? And today you see the results. Weren't it Washington and the CIA to be behind the creation of the so-called ISIS Islamists who terrorize the Middle East nowadays? So with the goal to position them as forces in the fight against Syria's President al-Assad. Question of the day is, who tells Washington to stop all that? So were $5 trillion wasted taxpayer dollars within the last 10 years not enough to let the American population wake up to the game being played by these guys? I think it is a very dangerous game, to be honest, and to be played that could eventually lead to the outbreak of World War III. I mean, we call ourselves the most civilized society in human history. It would be good if people put their money where their mouth is to show that. So now, for whatever reason, it's the nuclear power Russia who is in the spotlight of the Washington neocons and their European vessels. Isn't that crazy? Now, let me refer to something that has been picked up by Zero Hedge today. Zero Hedge reported, with reference to a report on consortiumnews.com, that the former NSA director and U.S. intelligence veterans wrote an open letter to German Chancellor Mrs. Merkel to avoid an all-out Ukraine war. Yeah, so let me cite a paragraph from this report. Here it is stated. I read for you. We, the undersigned, are longtime veterans of U.S. intelligence. We take the unusual step of writing this open letter to Mrs. Merkel to ensure that you have an opportunity to be briefed on our views prior to the NATO summit on the 4th and 5th of September. You need to know, for example, that accusations of a major Russian invasion of Ukraine appear not to be supported by reliable intelligence. Rather, the intelligence seems to be of the same dubious, politically fixed kind used 12 years ago to justify the U.S.-led attack on Iraq. We saw no credible evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq then, We see no credible evidence of a Russian invasion now. 12 years ago, former Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, mindful of the flimsiness of the evidence on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, refused to join in the attack on Iraq. In our view, you should be appropriately suspicious of charges made by the U.S. State Department and NATO officials alleging a Russian invasion of Ukraine. So, let me end here. But what I want to say is, and what do you say now? You think those hardliners will listen? Be reminded to the words of John Kerry, who has recently been saying that huge nations do not have the right to bully smaller ones. So do you think Kerry has ever thought about the 1 million casualties who became victims of a devastating Middle East strategy of the United States government? So what in the world provides the indispensable nation with the right to say anything like this? And what kind of ignorant double standards are they following in Washington? These are the questions more and more Germans start asking themselves. So let me come back to that topic. I've also mentioned in my article on the side of Craig Roberts. Let me come back to Western mainstream media in this context. So many people wondered that the so-called Ukrainian gas princess Tymoshenko was given a platform a couple of months ago to tell German readers in an interview with Springer's Die Welt that she would shoot a bullet through Vladimir Putin's head if she had the chance to do so. Do we need all this hate and this tendency of destruction in our German media landscape? I think the answer is no. And what Europe needs is to live together in peace and harmony. Now, fortunately, the majority of Europeans does not want to repeat the mistakes that had been made in the past and which led to the outbreak of World War I and World War II. So we do not want war. Yeah. Look, another thing that's interesting. Our Bundespräsident, or let me say the German head of state, his name is Gauck, started talking about a larger Bundeswehr engagement in the world at the beginning of this year. So the Western Russian-Ukrainian conflict had not even emerged or broken out at the time. And since then, the guy is telling the Germans they should prepare themselves for the acceptance of a greater military role of the country in the entire world.
Well, that's the last thing we need, is to Germany to remilitarize. I think that we've had enough for the rest of time of German militarization, and I think you would agree. Roman, we're out of time for this segment, and I appreciate your remarkable insights because you're one of the leading progressive voices in Germany and hence in Europe. And it's comes down, if I understand what you're saying, it comes down to this. Those who want to know the truth in Germany or other countries of the world will find those resources that give it to them, but it won't be the mainstream media either in Germany or in England or France or Spain or anywhere in America. They have to look for alternative sources such as Consortium News, Truth Dig, and Alternet, and some of those sources, including Progressive Radio Network. And the real reason, and you gave one example, the real thing is, if we look carefully at the Ukraine, we would have seen that where we were pounding the drums about these trucks going in there, 280 trucks, it turns out that the Red Cross and the Ukrainian government examined every single crate and every single one of those trucks, and it was just medicine and food and humanitarian supplies. We made it seem as if it was weapons and an invasion. It was not. You read a letter that I read this morning that had some of the major intelligence agents in our country's history saying there has been no invasion, and yet we're beating the drums for invasion. Why? Because at the end of the day, it is the Ukraine has three basic goals for the United States and the banking community. One, it is the breadbasket of Europe and hence has the richest soil and could, if it's controlled, including genetically engineered seeds, then it is an enormously rich source of food. Two, it could also be used for its other resources. And three, you could put NATO bases there right on the border with Russia, which we had promised not to do, and yet that's behind it. So we have to demonize everything occurring there, and we have to, same cast of characters, the same think tanks, the same so-called fascists that appear on the major media in the United States promoting this agenda, these are the people who the American media embrace without criticism, and you're saying the world is looking at this in a different way. So I'm going to thank you for doing that. From Germany, our first guest on today's show, Roman Baldzus, and we look forward to another conversation with him. Back in a moment with our second guest. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. My guest from Nova Scotia, Canada, is Professor Gary Leach. Gary Leach is the director of the Center for International Studies and a lecturer at the Department of Political Science at Cape Breton University in Nova Scotia. He's an independent journalist and an author, and he focuses upon the global struggle for social justice and on the U.S. intervention in Colombia under the war on drugs and the war on terror. His articles have appeared in around the world, and for 11 years he was the founding editor of the Columbia Journal with over 350 scholarly articles. He is the author of 7 books dealing with Colombia, the drug trade, broader critiques of capitalist globalization, and the influence of the fossil industry on global economics and politics. His most recent book is Capitalism, A Structural Genocide, which takes a hard look at how contemporary capitalism's inherent and fundamental structure generates inequality and violence and increased human suffering and death. His website is Gary, G-A-R-R-Y, Leach, L-E-E-C-H .com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me, Gary.
In your international studies, you focus primarily on Central and South America, where we are witnessing strong social movements in defiance of the Washington Consensus in many countries, and the International Monetary Fund is gradually loosening all of its influence since the creation of the Bank of the South in 2007. And Argentina right now is refusing to pay its debts to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Other countries have done likewise. Now, these nations' populations have seen how, for decades, the Bretton Woods organizations have largely controlled poorer nations' access to credit and development financing and have thereby kept them in perpetual debt. There's also the long history of U.S. government and covert operations in Latin America and supporting dictators like Pinochet in Chile and Videla in Argentina. And in Venezuela, the population has been strongly anti-American and perceives the U.S. solely as a supporter of the small aristocratic families who devastated Venezuela prior to Hugo Chavez coming to power. So what do you feel most Latin Americans think about the United States' role in their region and the world at large, and in particular the Obama White House?
Well, I think there's obviously, and not surprisingly, a broad variety of opinions of the United States, and I think it varies country to country, and it also varies depending on sectors of populations, which can be broken down into class and into race and different things like that that impact their opinions of the U.S. For example, in Colombia, most of the poverty in the country is in the countryside, is in the rural regions. And that is where U.S. military aid, the so-called U.S. war on drugs, has been played out. And the chemical warfare we've waged against farmers in that country has further entrenched poverty and caused massive displacement of these peoples. So that many of the rural poor in a country like Colombia do not view the U.S. favorably. They do not view U.S. policies favorably. And whereas if you go into the cities and among the middle class, and particularly among the upper class in the capital, Bogota, and the other big cities, Medellin and Cali, you're going to have a much more favorable view of the U.S. because they're economically aligned with multinational corporations and U.S. Neoliberal policies that they are benefiting from. They are generating great wealth for themselves from. So you've got this diversity of opinions. As you mentioned, in Venezuela, that's a country that suffered under neoliberalism through the 80s and 90s. It differs from the other countries in that the people actually finally managed to elect a government that was anti-U.S. imperialism, that was anti-neoliberalism. The Chavez government decided to use Venezuela's oil resources to benefit the poor in Venezuela. And it stands apart because they've managed to keep this anti-neoliberal, anti-US imperialist government in place, because US history has always tried to undermine and overthrow such governments. They overthrew the reformist government in Guatemala in 1954. They've tried for decades to overthrow Cuba's government. They've overthrown Salvador Allende, the democratically elected socialist leader in Chile in 1973, and installed the Pinochet dictatorships. So throughout history, the U.S. has always sought to undermine and overthrow governments that have challenged its interests in the region and replace it with compliant governments, such as they have in Colombia right now. So Venezuela is a current example of the emerging challenge to the U.S., and to lesser degrees we see it in Ecuador, in Argentina, in Bolivia. And this is a new wave of the left in Latin America that isn't like the centralized socialism of the Soviet era, that is looking for a more democratic model and a more equal distribution of the region's resources to benefit the people of the region rather than U.S. corporations and U.S. economy.
Thank you for that insight. On a separate issue, though we'll come back to the main theme, I would like for you to give us your impression of what the war on drugs, America's war on drugs, has actually contributed to the crime rate, the death rate, the impoverishment rate, the imprisonment rate, and the overall culture of corruption in Colombia or any other country you'd like to share with us, and that standing in stark contrast to the neoliberal and right and left wing, the corporate Democrats, because it was Clinton and Obama who supported vigorously the war on crimes. Interesting, since they both did hard drugs and should have been in prison if they weren't hypocrites. But we know what hypocrisy our presidents are. In fact, all members of our Congress. So on the one hand, the American media, led by Bill O'Reilly, will say, we don't want legalization of any of these, because the moment you legalize one, it leads to another, and then the whole nation's drugged out and killing each other. Tell us your perspective. Give us an honest evaluation of what has actually happened because of our failed war on drugs.
The so-called war on drugs is a perfect example of the chaos that the United States causes in a region like Latin America. For example, we're constantly hearing in recent years from U.S. politicians, from our government leaders, from analysts, and from mainstream media that Plan Colombia, the counter-narcotics initiative launched in 2000 by Clinton, has been a success. Coca cultivation, that's the raw ingredient, the crop that is the raw ingredient for cocaine, has diminished dramatically in Colombia, and so therefore it's a successful model. But that is only successful if you look at Colombia with blinders on, if you look at it separated, isolated from the rest of Latin America. Because what we've seen is the coca cultivation has shifted to Peru and Bolivia. It's increased in those countries. The center of drug trafficking activities is now Mexico. It's the Mexican cartels who control the international trafficking, not the Colombian cartels anymore. So what we've done is displaced coca cultivation from Colombia to Peru and Bolivia, and we've displaced the organized crime and violence related to the drug trade from Colombia to Mexico. And the free trade model in the form of NAFTA, the massive increase in the flow of goods across the U.S.-Mexican border, has made it much easier for the Mexican cartels to get cocaine into the United States. So while we look at Colombia then as this success story, it can only be seen as a success if we ignore the negative consequences in Peru, in Bolivia, in Mexico. So we create all this havoc, and that, of course, is only a success in Colombia if you ignore the millions of people who have been displaced by the violence in Colombia, in the war on drugs and the war on terror. There were still massive human rights abuses going on. And so we go in there with this so-called mission, a war on drugs mission, and at the end of the day, cocaine is still flowing into the United States, into Europe, and other parts of the world, We haven't diminished overall production. We've diminished it in Colombia, but it's a balloon effect. It's just shifted to other countries, along with all the social consequences. And at the end of the day, the war on drugs is not about fighting drugs. In Colombia, it was all about securing access to the country's natural resources. It's oil, it's coal. And as a result of Plan Colombia, the militarization of Colombia has provided security in rural regions that were previously controlled by the guerrillas. And that security has allowed foreign oil companies and mining companies to flood into Colombia. And we now hold Colombia up as an example of economic development because of all of its economic growth. But what's happened is millions of people have been displaced off their lands so foreign companies can access the oil, the coal, and then all of that oil and coal is exported to support our lifestyles. And that means all that wealth is leaving the country, other than a small minority, the rich elites in Colombia, who are getting their share of the wealth. That wealth is leaving. Sure, it shows up in Colombia's GDP as economic growth, but the resources and the wealth generated from those resources in the global market leaves in the pockets of foreign corporations. But Colombia is held up as an example of a successful war against drugs, as economic growth, and also as democracy. And yet Colombia's presidential election this year had by far the lowest turnout of any election in Latin America. Only about 42% of the voting population turned out. And consistently it's the lowest turnout because there's so much apathy and cynicism and disbelief in their democratic system. Meanwhile, we constantly look at Venezuela and accuse it of being an authoritarian regime, undemocratic, and yet it regularly has the highest voter turnouts in the region, 82%. It's many more people participate in Venezuela's elections than any other country in the region. But our propaganda has to convince us that our policies in Colombia are working on every level, the war on drugs, economically, democracy promotion. But in reality, it's another form of exploiting the resources and the cheap labor of the region to stuff the pockets and the profits of our corporations and to support our unsustainable lifestyles here in the United States.
For most people who have finally seen the light that the U.S. corporate media, such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, the networks, Fox, are not to be trusted with reporting practically anything accurately or honestly. Hence, we have to turn to either alternative free speech media here in the United States or get our reporting from foreign news sources. Therefore, the average citizen outside the United States, in my opinion, has more reliable news and analysts working than you'll find in the United States, especially when it involves any foreign affairs. Consequently, populations in other countries are far more likely to have a very different perception and understanding of the U.S.'s role in the world and what its intentions in global dominance might be. Based upon that, can you share examples based upon your conversations and resources on what you perceive to be the general view the world has today on U.S. foreign policy, and particularly regarding the expansion of its military operations globally?
Yeah, it's an important point and that you raise, and it's true, because in foreign countries, their media is more likely to critique U.S. foreign policy, particularly if it's having negative impacts in that country. Whereas U.S. citizens, as you said, are just receiving most of the information from the mainstream media, and because of cutbacks and the neoliberalism, the corporate media doesn't even have correspondents throughout most of the world. So they're over-reliant on government sources, White House sources, State Department sources for foreign affairs issues. And so you're getting a propaganda that is dominated by the official line, and that is the information, the root of the information that the U.S. public receives. But in other countries, where not only are the people getting a different perspective from their media who are critiquing U.S. policy, but the people are also experiencing that policy directly, whereas U.S. citizens primarily receive the benefit from it, all the resources, the cheap goods that they can consume and everything else. But on the other end, These people are the cheap laborers. They're the ones exploited, working in dangerous conditions. They're suffering the environmental consequences, the health consequences. They're suffering the repression of the brutal regimes that we support. You know, we run around the world claiming to promote democracy, but we turn a blind eye to all our allies who are not democratic, who are human rights abusers, Saudi Arabia being a perfect example. How come we've never called for democracy and human rights in a close ally like that? But these people who live in these countries, they are on the receiving end of these policies. So not only do they learn about them from the media, they learn about them from their daily life experience. And this is why Venezuela and Ecuador and Brazil created an alternative media network in Latin America called Telesur, Southern Television. And the idea was because U.S. media, throughout the 90s, was starting to dominate even in overseas, in Latin America. You'd get Fox News in Spanish on their cable networks. You'd get CNN International in Spanish throughout Latin America. So the U.S. corporate media was starting to heavily influence views in Latin America as well in their propaganda war down there. And so many of these countries have created this alternative network now that is broadcast in most countries in Latin America, that has an online presence, and it's a counter the CNN, the Fox News corporate model, and to present alternative views. And it is very critical of U.S. policies. And this is another example, again, of the resistance to U.S. imperialism in Latin America.
I certainly appreciate these insights, and I want to thank you very much, Professor Gary Leach, for being on with us. His newest book is Capitalism, A Structural Genocide. The website is Gary, G-A-R-R-Y, Leech, L-E-E-C-H.com. Back in a moment with our final guest. Andrei Vilcek is a journalist, a novelist, a filmmaker, a poet, a playwright, and a philosopher. He has, like Chris Hedges, covered dozens of war zones and conflicts with a focus upon the plight of oppressed and colonized people around the world. Among these areas have been Bosnia, the Ukraine, Timor, Indonesia, Peru, Sri Lanka, the Republic of the Congo, and other African nations. Among his most recent books are Fighting Against Western Imperialism and On Western Terrorist, From Hiroshima to Drone Warfare, which was co-written by Noam Chomsky and will be turned into a film. His work is substantial. He has a deep knowledge, and he has a unique way of answering in not just short comments, but rather weaving his answer into stories that gives a better context, the history of something, the cast of characters. And he also spent time looking at the Rwanda situation, which challenges the official story about the genocide in Rwanda and the plunder of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And we intend to invite him back for a one-hour program just with him on the Progressive Commentary Hour in the near future on that. He is also a senior fellow at the Oakland Institute, and his articles and essays have appeared in Counterpunch, Asian Times, China Daily, Irish Times, Z Magazine, and Asia Pacific. His website is andrevltchek.weebly.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to hear, to be on your program. Thank you.
Andre, most Americans continue to have a view that the rest of the world loves us because of our exceptionalism. I want to have you share with us how, in one respect, from the rest of the world, we've taken a Luciferian fall from grace. What do they think of us?
I don't know where to begin, but let me begin with the Syrian opposition. I had been working at two places where they had been trained. One is outside of the Turkish city called Hatay, which is historically very tolerant city that counts with different Islamic movements, with Christians and other people, and the city of Hatay was actually turned into the refugee area of refugee camps on the Syrian border. And I worked there twice. Once I actually went there to write a report, and the second time I was making a film for Telesur, the television station in Venezuela. What I witnessed was that the entire area around the Turkish city of Hatay, between the city and the border with Syria, was overtaken by Islamist jihadis. There were people, I talked to many Turkish colleagues, I talked to the villagers, and I was told that this peaceful city is actually experiencing absolute fear and horror, that so-called Syrian opposition is crossing the borders, they are intimidating villagers, they are stealing, they are killing, and so on and so on. There is a camp, which is, there are several refugee camps, and two or three of them are legitimate refugee camps, but one of them is extremely hardened refugee camp, and it's not really a refugee camp, it's actually a training base for the Islamist jihadi cadres. And first time when I was photographing and talking to people around there, there was no problem. Second time when I came for Telesur, basically they chased us, they intimidated us, we got arrested, and the Turkish military was in it, the Turkish police, there was some fusion between them and some bearded man who were trying to delete all our images and films and so on. So basically we asked who are these people in Hatay? And we were said that there is a lot of U.S. allies or Western allies from Saudi Arabia and from Qatar. Now, this is one of the camps. Then there is another camp, which is not a refugee camp. It's actually enormous military air force base close to the city of Adana, which is about 200 kilometers or 130 miles north from there. And that's RAF camp. It's an RAF base, and it's a U.S. Air Force base. And, that they fly from the Turkish military base. And this is also the place where they are training the so-called opposition. And I was told this by my colleagues in Istanbul, investigative journalists from the newspaper called Aydınlık. And Aydınlık is the place where when Hillary Clinton would come to Turkey, she would beg the Turkish government to shut them down, actually, because they were too outspoken and, for her taste, too anti-American. So this is one area where it's absolutely clear that the Syrian opposition was trained and armed and financed. I worked on the border. I talked to Turkish border guards who were telling me how the Syrian fighters come cross the border, because Turks couldn't cross anymore even last year. So it was only Syrian so-called opposition that would cross. So they would cross to Syria, they would fight, and at night they would bring them either as casualties, as wounded people, or they would just cross back to get more ammunition and food and supplies, and just to rest before the next round of fighting. A few months ago, I was in Jordan, which is another area. There are two big refugee camps, one new, one old, and the same story there. I talked to people on the ground. I talked to my anonymous diplomatic sources there, and it's absolutely clear, there is no secret that they are being trained, that the Syrian opposition was trained there as well, and is being trained there. So we have this situation which in Iraq right now, and we all know where it's all coming from. It's again, these are, as you very correctly pointed out, these are people who we were supporting, we were training. Very similar situation to Afghanistan during the Soviet era and during the Soviet war, when the Soviet Union was actually lulled into this into the conflict, and the West was supporting Mujahideen. All this Al Qaeda has bases there in that time, and it was trained, armed, supported by the CIA. It was supported by Americans, by West Europeans, and so on. And these were fighters that were coming from everywhere, from Saudi Arabia, from Qatar, but also from as far as Indonesia and Malaysia and these are the people that are now being called terrorists. So that is about the Syrian opposition, about what's going on in Iraq. Now, about the presidency, about Obama, and about George Bush. Look, I think that what is happening in Western Europe and in the United States is sinking to the level of some client states like Indonesia. As you know, in Indonesia in 1965, we supported one of the most brutal coups in the history of the mankind. About between 2 and 3 million people died. Communists, left-wing thinkers, teachers, artists, Chinese people that belong to Chinese minority. So these people died because they were actually killed. There was a list of the that U.S. embassy gave to Indonesian military. They went overboard, and together with the religious cadres, they murdered about 200 times more people that they were asked to murder. But Indonesia descended to this to the dictatorship, which actually is very interesting because it was not just a dictatorship. It was a concept which was later implemented in many places, from Chile in 1973 to Russia under Yeltsin. But even more interestingly, the so-called Western democracies are resembling this model increasingly more and more. So in Indonesia, for instance, there were elections this year. And there were two main candidates. One candidate was his name is Prabowo, and he's an outright criminal. He was responsible for killing in East Timor during the occupation. And the other candidate is Jokowi, who was actually a mayor of the smaller city called Solo, and then he became mayor of Jakarta. He's not a criminal, but if you look at the list of the people who are behind him, they are all military and all big business men, and so on and so on. So you have two candidates who are basically representing the very similar group of people, the turbo capitalists, you know, the military complex and all this. And then you tell people, look, go and vote. You have freedom to choose between two candidates, and therefore you have democracy. So it doesn't really matter if both candidates belong to the same group. It doesn't really matter if these people were pre-selected. You know, what really matters is that people go, like in some novel of José Saramago, you know, they go and they stick pieces of paper and you know, and then they go back and they feel good about themselves. So this is democracy, to which I think U.S. Is also deteriorating. So instead of so-called developing world getting some good practices from the West, I don't think there is much that West can offer after, you know, centuries of horrible colonialism and neocolonialism. But still, I mean, instead of you know, getting some good points, it's the West which is learning from its own concepts that they implemented in their colonies, like Indonesia, or neo-colonies, or client states, like Indonesia, for example. So it's a very disturbing trend. What is also very disturbing is, like in a country like Indonesia, also in the United States or in Western Europe, people are not realizing that it's all a charade, that these entire elections are charade. Like, for instance, when Obama was elected for the first time, people were crying and they said, yes, we can, you know, and can what? I mean, nobody could get to that point in Indonesia or in the United States. You know, even they could never get to this point without being approved fully by the establishment and by the regime. So these people are pre-selected already. So it's but nobody seems to really realize. And people go and they naively put these pieces of paper to those boxes. So I think it's quite similar.
The United States would benefit tremendously if Ukraine became a part of NATO, the countries that supported NATO, and which are many, and that way they could set up entire armaments right on Russia's border, in effect helping to substantially have a preemptive attack against it. And yet the public was not told this. The public was also not told that we should have disbanded NATO decades ago.
During Gorbachev, of course, when he was fooled.
Yeah. So when you look at all these conflicts, you look at the fact that we're virtually on the wrong side of every conflict historically for the last 45, 50 years. What are the people around the world saying? The people that the average person, but also those who are much more educated, and that is important that we know what people are thinking.
Well, I think people are scared, first of all. In many parts of the world, they are even scared to think. I work, of course, in Latin America, I work in Africa, but I also work a lot in Asia, and that's where I live. And I can tell you, some parts of Asia, particularly Southeast Asia, nobody would dare to go against the official narrative. Because places like Indonesia, like Thailand, like Philippines, are basically Western colonies. And it's a very complex system. You see it in India, but not to such an extent. But basically the way it works is that if you are anybody in these countries in Southeast Asia, you have to have either Western education, or you have to work for the Western company, or you have to have at least some connections, and you have to speak English. So what happens is that if you would go as a journalist, as an intellectual, if you would go against the official Western narrative, you would be destroyed. Not killed anymore, not raped anymore. You would just not be invited, you will not be allowed to join to work for television stations, for newspapers, you would not be allowed to go and study abroad, and so on. You would not be landing any decent job at a multinational company. So there is enormous self-censorship, and you particularly see it in countries like Malaysia, right? Because it's English-speaking, it's a middle-income country, it's not poor. But people would never talk about anything that could jeopardize their position in this international environment. Now you have countries where the elites, and this is what actually is happening. The elites are always now the self-censoring themselves. I see it in East Africa also. Because they actually know that the only way to progress and to reach this elite status that they are longing for, they have to play with the West. Now, in Latin America, we all know that it's totally different. Latin America is standing on its own feet proudly. It has its own media. It has its own way of thinking. It has its own social, economic system. So right there, Latin America is somewhere else. China is somewhere else. Russia is somewhere else. Iran, I want to believe that South Africa. But most of the countries are just, they know what is going on. They are very angry, particularly places like in the Middle East. But they cannot really pull themselves together. The fear is too big, and the punishment is horrific. So there is suppressed anger. You can see it like in Indonesia, for example, where everybody speaks publicly about how much they need to cooperate with the U.S. and with Europe and all this. And then you see them behind the doors, and they're very angry, and they're very frustrated with themselves too, because they are collaborating, the elites. So it's a very complicated, very unhealthy situation right now. But I noticed, and what I described in my latest book, Fighting Against Western Imperialism, I believe that there is an absolutely new dynamics now developed in the last 10 years. I think we have a very powerful alliance against the Western neocolonialism. Most of the countries in this alliance belong to BRICS, except India, where I just went to and I wrote the article or essay called India, Where Is It? On Two Chairs. So there are two, except India, we have Brazil and actually most of Latin America. We have Russia, China, and South Africa. And these countries are core of whatever we agree with everything what they do or say, but this is a core of countries that are fighting for their right and the right of other countries all over the world to go and to develop in their own way. These countries have different social systems, but they also have very powerful media. And I work for Telesur in Venezuela, which is a very powerful television station that combines the maybe the best South American, Latin American filmmakers. We are shooting back to the United States and to Europe there, you know, the propaganda. They shoot at us, we shoot back. RT, Russia Today, powerful. I write for them. CCTV is in China is getting their act together. And Press TV in Iran is actually doing also very important work. So it's political, it's also economic, the cooperation of these countries, and it's also on the level of intellectual cooperation and mass media.
I want to thank you for taking your time from Japan today by Skype to be on. My guest, Andrei Vilcek, and we look forward to having him back. I'm Gary Knoll.